Hi, I'm Scott Sosby, and we are here with Charles Simpson. I'm also here with Paul Sandel and Laura Blackburn. We're in the Russell Office Building in Washington. Mr. Simpson was Charlie Wilson's first chief of staff here when he was in Congress. Welcome, Charles. We're glad you're here.
Good to be here.
And this is part of the Charlie Wilson Oral History Project. We'll go ahead and... Now you can just continue. You were when you left Charlie's staff. Tell us about the grand jury. I mean, we were already going with that story.
I was still on his staff when the grand jury. There were two in the office that had to testify, I'll let the other one tell you who she was.
Okay.
But it was Carol Simon, and her name was Simons then, and she is was his secretary. So we both did testify. It was not a grueling experience. It was one of those things that should never have happened, and yet it did. So that was it.
About that and that investigation and how they came out. Was Charlie concerned about that? I mean, was he genuinely concerned, or was he...
About what?
About being indicted to perhaps having charges brought, maybe having to leave Congress? Was it a concern?
He never thought he would have to leave Congress. Of course he's concerned, because it was a, as he would say, it was a bullshit deal. Mm-hmm. And so that there was, I'll say right quick and right up front, I never ever saw him use any kind of controlled substance. Mm-hmm. Charlie had fun. Mm-hmm. And he did. If he couldn't have fun doing it, he wasn't going to do it. Mm-hmm. And yet he had the best mind of anyone around and was way ahead of everybody. Doesn't get that credit, never did, but he could take any issue and cut away all of the chaff, go right to the heart of it, and that's all he needed. Yeah.
And was that his special gift as a lawmaker?
I'd say it's probably one of the key things about Charlie Wilson. I think it was honed a bit in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And some of that honing in the Navy, if you talk to some of his old Navy buddies, I had an opportunity to do a little bit. He had reason at the Naval Academy to hone those skills.
That's correct.
When you graduate in the bottom 10, it's really something. And the best example of that, and I don't know whether you all are going to have in any of the papers that they gave you or not, for that are in the libraries, when he came back from the Med, being over there for his tour on a destroyer, his captain wrote up all of his officers, and he wrote about Charlie. And Charlie had that in his trunk that his mother had at in Trinity. The letter was that Charlie was undoubtedly the best officer. That he was the best officer he'd ever had at sea. Mm-hmm. He was a gunnery officer. Mm-hmm. And he won every, his team won, his ship won every challenge that they met against mm-hmm. the American other ships out there when they were practicing. But he was undoubtedly the worst he'd ever had under his command in, when they were in shore, had a shore.
So. A sailor in every respect. Good. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'll tell too many stories.
Well, we want to hear those stories.
You need to guide me back.
I was going to go back to you and probably you first meeting. When's the first time you met
First Charlie? Time I met Charlie was I was teaching a night political science, political parties course. I had a graduate student, history graduate student in that course who wanted to write a paper on some local politician. He was from Longview. And so there was a great competition for state senate between Bob Murphy, who was a district judge or county judge. It's in those papers, or this one, one of them. And Charlie. Two counties divided by the Angelina River. The people were just as divided as if that river were a wall. Because when it came to Charlie Wilson, because unfairly they did not want anyone representing them who tried to improve the racial problems that were prevalent in East Texas at that mm-hmm. time. And they resented, I think, the success that Dieball had, because if you study Dieball, Texas, mm-hmm. you'll see mm-hmm. that was a great success with its libraries, with its education mm-hmm. for everybody, even though some of the people lived, the workers in the mills over there, lived in houses or apartments that were built by Arthur Temple. They all had great educations, and they all ate well, and they all made enough money to go to Houston every now and then. Mm-hmm. And in Nacogdoches, it wasn't that way.
Is that what soured Charlie on Nacogdoches?
Well, Archie asked me to tell you, and I don't know exactly what Archie was talking about.
We've heard from a number of people that Charlie didn't like Nacogdoches, that he thought that Nacogdoches didn't support him enough, that he would just assume that they weren't in his district.
If I had not been his chief of staff, I'm from Nacogdoches. Mm-hmm. I mean, Wichita Falls is a long ways off, and it was very different. My wife and I had never walked into an area like Nacogdoches, which we loved. Uh-huh. We loved the city, mm-hmm. and we loved the people there, but we didn't agree with a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, that was pretty much, they would not, no one over there would support him. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't gotten some people together, and if Arthur Temple hadn't come over and set up a meeting to raise a little money for him, they wouldn't have done anything. Mm-hmm. The way I met Charlie, getting back to that, mm-hmm. was I sent this graduate student, he said, well, how do I get in touch with Charlie? I said, just pick up the phone, call him. And I had not met him. Mm-hmm. He picked up the phone and called him, and then he called me, or I came back to class on Monday. That must have been on Friday. And said, well, I spent all day Sunday with Charlie and Jerry, his first wife. They lived on Crooked Creek in Lufkin. And he said, I have 2 gallons of Elmer's glue in my trunk and a whole stack of Charlie Wilson posters. And I'm the chairman now. He was for 4 counties in East Texas. And they mapped out all of the empty storefronts with glass on the front of them that those placards belonged on.
Is that right?
And so I'm supposed to go. Oh, they gave me a big paintbrush too. And so he said, "I want you to go over and meet him with me sometime." So I did, and got acquainted with Charlie and Jerry. Charlie is one that includes everybody. He doesn't exclude people, whether that's staff or whoever it happens to be. I mean, he can look at you and tell whether he wants you around or wants to associate with you, but he includes people and makes them feel good about themselves. And he did that when we came to Washington, to the chagrin of the Texas delegation and others who, you know, they didn't want to associate with all of those wild-eyed liberals. And that's what they labeled him in Nacogdoches. Mm-hmm. He's not a liberal, but he is a progressive. And he started nothing, came up, but he had a mother that pushed him and a father that let him have a little drink of whiskey once in a while that his mother wouldn't.
What was, this is a, you're a great person to ask us too. We've asked this question a lot. What was Charlie's political philosophy? I mean, he has the moniker liberal from Lufkin, but what was Charlie's political philosophy? How would you describe him?
For East Texas, yeah, he was liberal. I think that's why I like the word inclusive. He didn't want anybody to be outside the loop. He wanted everybody to have the same opportunities he had had. And that's really shown through, I think, in a lot of the appointments to the Naval Academies that he was able to make. I mean, to the military academies. Charlie felt like people were people. And that we could learn something from all of them. He was a moderate. He didn't vote with Arthur Temple all the time. And I use Arthur's name because the two of them go somewhat together, some of that falsely and some of it correctly. Let me give you a little example that I hadn't talked about it, said anything about it, was that Charlie and we got acquainted, but we didn't get real acquainted. And I'm a little bit, you may not think that from today, but I don't just fall all over myself getting to know somebody. And I don't I'm not that outgoing at times, sure. But things I know about I can talk about. Charlie's much that way too.
Is that right?
He gives people responsibility immediately, watches how they perform, and the people that work with him and for him. And that's true of staff as well. Staff members were his friends, or they weren't his staff members. And we did not have to let many go. I've diverted myself now. I started telling you about some example, and I'll pick it up.
You were about Arthur Temple, so we can do with this. You can do an example with Arthur, and you can expound on what Charlie's relationship with Arthur was.
Okay, Arthur was someone who gave him a job and expected as much of him as he expected of anybody, and more than most. Charlie was one as eager to do it. And the example I was going to give you is that Charlie's salary, I happen to know because I did. He trusted me. I mean, mm-hmm. why? I don't know. but we became not buddy-buddy type friends, but there was nothing that he didn't keep me advised of. And I went my way, and he went his way. He wanted me... let me go back to this story before I get away from it. I had no idea what Charlie was going to have me do, because I came up here twice with him after the Democratic primary, mm-hmm. and he had won it so big. He knew he was going to be congressman. He did not tell me that I was going to be his AA, but he had asked me if I'd be interested. And I said I would like to look at it and see and talk to the family and that sort of thing. So I'd never been to Washington. But we flew up here in July of 66. No, July, I gave my dates, that's a Senate race. The July of 72. And when we got here, it only cost $13 to come in from Dulles in a cab.
Time has changed.
It's the first time I've been on a jet airplane, too. It was a new world, and it's just the two of us. But I want to go back and pick up on this, what I was telling you about Arthur. Eventually... the first paycheck he got, or when he got paid, Arthur owed him money after we came up here in December. He got that paycheck and he gave it to me, and he says, go get this broken down into two or go get a deposit in the bank. And he'd set up an account, and I took it over and got it. And tell him you want 25% of it to in a form that we can send to my workers at the Big Ten Barn in Diboll. So that was his final check. He made $12,000 a year, but he got a bonus for whatever they grossed. Mm-hmm. And his check that year was a $49,000 bonus. He took 25% of that, and he sent it back to his foreman, or his assistant manager at the Big Ten Barn, to divide among the employees of the Big Ten Barn.
Says a lot about him.
It does. And it said an awful lot to me about him at that time. It was just unreal. So that's the kind of guy he was. He didn't care about race. I mean, he cared about race, but he didn't care about his employees or anyone else. They weren't hired that basis. Arthur Temple didn't hire him that way. They were his friends. And that is a great, I think, story for Charlie Wilson, because he did emulate Arthur to that extent. Now, the thing that Charlie didn't do was ever get rich until people started paying him so much to represent him after he got out of Congress, and or to give a speech. He called me. I called him and asked him. Someone had asked me if he wanted to give a speech, one of the last ones he gave. And he says, "Well, Simpson, that's pretty good money now. Can you imagine anybody ever paying me $25,000 for a speech?" Anyway.
But what about Arthur? I mean, he and Charlie's relationship was, I mean, it was obviously close.
It was.
They respected each other. There was an affection there, for sure. But you said he didn't vote with Arthur all the time.
That's right.
So, what did Arthur expect him to?
No, of course not. Arthur didn't put pressure on him. They fought over the big thicket. They were Arthur's trees. He wanted to keep them. Charlie says he knows and I know they're not any good for timber. The people deserve part of all of this that he has accumulated down there for posterity. We need to have some of it they can walk around in and some of it they can camp in. And it ought to be available to everybody. And he and Arthur went back and forth about a lot of that because it was the nicest hardwood timber land in East Texas that Arthur had taken care of, had built up, and it was old. But it was that kind of relationship. We know also and that in the Senate that when you have huge forests, heavy trucks and equipment working in a specific area, it is really nice to have good roads. Everybody accused him of that. But farm market roads were growing all over the state of Texas, and the state senators and state representatives were the ones that were helping guide where that went, and Charlie was pretty good at guiding it. So they agreed on those kinds of things because it went to Sam Rayburn, which was a brand new lake at that time. Toledo Bend was being built. You got to have access to it. You wanted to have multiple use. And if you can't get your boat down there, it's not as nice as it is if you can get your boat down there. You got a road to get there. And the state bore some of that responsibility. So, but Arthur was good to everybody. He was a good businessman. He's a hard-nosed businessman. He ran a check every Saturday on every job he had down there, and that Cadillac would come into the Big Ten barn, and Arthur had his clipboard and his pen, and he drove slowly around it and then made notes. And he wanted it to be clean. He wanted the lumber to be stacked. He wanted everything to be in order. And he wanted the stack to be shorter than it was when he was there last Saturday. He saw to that, and he reported to everybody.
Now, how did Charlie get Arthur to agree, or if maybe agree is the wrong word, but get Arthur around the big thicket?
It just became inevitable. And most people don't want to give up something totally freely. And if you hold out a little bit, you get a little more credit sometimes than if you just say, okay, here it is, y'all have it. Arthur wasn't dumb. He was, and like I said, he took care of his people. Charlie just told him he was going to do it. It was one of those things. Charlie wanted to be independent of everybody.
Now, but I mean, it's amazing to me. Charlie Wilson's a freshman congressman, just elected. Ralph Yarbrough's been working on the big thicket for years. A senator,
yeah,
he can't get anything done.
Yeah.
One term, Charlie gets the big thicket done.
Right.
How do you do that?
He made that his major piece of legislation. The first one that he was going to pass, he campaigned on that down there. Said that it's going to be done. And he persuaded Arthur that it needed to be done and it would be beneficial to him.
Is that what it was? Could Yarbrough just never convince Arthur Temple?
Yarbrough was, there was a different relationship. I mean, Yarbrough's older than Arthur was. He didn't live in the big thicket. He may have fished in some of the rivers down there, but he didn't live there. And Yarbrough was coming down with a hammer. Charlie had a little velvet on it, because there's no doubt that Arthur could have dealt him a lot of misery. But that wasn't going to happen. There had been a relationship. He was a good businessman, sold more lumber than any finished lumber than anybody else in East Texas. That is, Charlie did at the Big Ten Barn with his truckload of chicky babes at every parade and fair that they had down there. When you've seen pictures, maybe, of sitting in the swings and swing dressed like birds. Mm-hmm. And East Texans liked that. And Arthur liked the revenue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was not, as some people suggested, that he was, particularly when he was in the Texas Senate, Arthur Temple Senator. That's really not the case.
No, not at all.
Well, so we have to ask you about maybe whether you may not have knowledge of this. Maybe it was an apocryphal story. I don't know. When he was in the Senate, and he was the first goes to the Senate, he's first elected to the Senate, there's this coterie of young Turk liberals that we're going to change things. He, Joe Christie, Barbara Jordan, among them. And the story we heard was from one of them in that group that they had going to pass this bill to actually institute a corporate income tax in Texas. We're going to start making corporations have it. And they knew it was going to be close. But they had gotten together and they counted the votes and it looked like it was going to be real close. But they were going to make it because you roll call by alphabetical order. It was probably going to be just about time. But Charlie Wilson was going to cast the vote that was going to make that happen. But when time came for that vote to be casted, Charlie voted no. The person who told us that said, I knew we were in trouble because the day before, Arthur's Cadillac showed up. And I know he was going to Charlie's office, and I knew that was going to cause Charlie to vote against it. I haven't heard anybody that can verify that story.
Art, I don't know the story, so I have no idea. Arthur had more influence on him probably than anyone else. And I'm sure that
does it sound like something Temple would have done? Because it doesn't.
I think it would have. He would have let him know that it would not be good for the economy down there across the state, and that they would have problems with it. But I would say that Arthur, and I have no idea. I never sat in on a conversation between the two, or Charlie didn't talk about Arthur. But he was always available for advice or whatever. When Charlie needed some advice.
And question I have now. You're with him then in 72, 73. Obviously, had followed a little bit of his career prior to that. How was the reaction to Charlie? Because he is winning in East Texas, and he is voting pro-civil rights issues and pro-women's rights issues that, shall we say, are not the most popular of things at the time in East Texas. Is he getting a lot of pushback for that? I mean, obviously, how is he still able to get elected?
A lot of different ways. The biggest one was that in Charlie's mind, people are people. And keep in mind, he had been here in the Naval Academy for 4 years, over here in Annapolis. His duty then at the Pentagon during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was the young lieutenant running information back and forth, the pictures that we were getting of the missile sites and what have you, for the officers, the admirals, generals. He saw living conditions other places instead of East Texas. He was a real humanitarian. It wasn't a matter of getting away with it. It was a matter of persuading people.
Okay.
That it would be better for them as well as East Texas. And he focused on East Texas. That was number one when he came up here, when he was in the Senate. And he had 12 years in the legislature. Mm-hmm. So he had learned some skills. And he did run with that leadership group. He was very close to Ben Barnes, who was the lieutenant governor in the Senate. Although he and Ben were not necessarily always together on things, there was mutual respect that they all had. Everybody had their committee, everybody had their territory, everybody became the expert on those things, and everybody had something they had to do. Mm-hmm. And that they had told their people back home they were going to do, and they did it. And Charlie, if he had no children. He and Jerry never had children. But he had cats. And Jerry had a little dog. And they lived with me for a month when we came to Washington. They didn't have an apartment. Well, they did. They got an apartment from a economics professor who was going back to the University of Texas for a semester, and Charlie and Jerry rented it from him in one of the big apartment complexes here. And they stayed there 1 week. And he called me on Saturday morning after we had shut down and says, "Simpson, my wife wasn't up here. She and the kids, Kyle wanted to." He kept her in Texas because he was an athlete and he wanted to finish track season. And so she and Terry stayed there until he finished track season. No, not quite, but almost. So I was living alone. Wade pulled a trailer up here with one room of furniture and a spoon and a knife and a few things. And Charlie called me and said, "Simpson, come get us. Jerry and I are sitting out here on the curb and we need a place to spend the night. So we're going to move in with you." I had a 4-bedroom house out there that we had been able to get. And I said, "Well, you have to buy a bed." He said, "Okay, we'll go shop it." So they had brought Ernest the cat that Charlie had picked up between Lufkin and Diabol along the highway when he was a little bitty kitten. And he just could not pass up an animal like that. He could not, he had feelings for people, animals, and that was just him. That's why he could get along with everybody, is he had those feelings. And so Ernest came out and tore, they lived with him a month until they got an apartment. And Ernest tore all the drapes down in the house, and the others he kind of shredded because he had claws. No. And that was the reason that this professor and his wife did not want him living in the water gates where they were.
Is that right?
Subletting his apartment. They kept a key to that apartment and came in and saw Ernest sharpening his claws on their couch. And so Charlie just—I can't imagine what he told him. They left.
Wow.
But Wilson in the meetings we had when I was working with him on the congressional campaign, we met with 60 black ministers in East Texas in the basement of one of the churches in Lufkin's. There was Charlie, Buddy Temple, who's Arthur wanted to take, or Buddy wanted to take Charlie's place in the Senate. There was Buddy, Charlie, one other person, and me. There were four white people. There were those 60 black ministers in the basement. And he was just, it was like a spiritual meeting almost with those ministers. They needed help. They wanted some rights. They wanted to be treated fairly. And Charlie wanted them to. And there was no difference of opinion whatsoever at that point. We had other meetings. But they then went out, and Charlie was appealing to them to support him, that their voting rights would be protected, that they would not be intimidated in the counties by the sheriff and the sheriff's deputies standing at there when they went into the courthouse to do something with their guns on, or when they wanted to register to vote, pay their poll tax, whatever they had to do. He said, "We will get rid of the poll tax and do everything we can," which was done just before he left the Senate. You still had to register, but you didn't have to pay anything. And that's what Carl Davis, a number of us, got together and helped with to process those and get them down to the courthouse and get them processed properly. They didn't have to have pictures taken. We didn't have to have pictures taken. Nothing. I mean, that was the system that was set up by the legislature to do it. And those animals, his basset hound went with him, and he went into the East Texas woods to visit with these people. He didn't wear a tie, but he didn't like to wear a tie. He wore a tie. He dressed, I started to say impeccably. My wife would say grotesquely.
He was very colorful.
But I won't speak for her. But he was sharp. Always was. But he treated everybody alike.
But he was still able. I mean, that's all you and that's his quality that's fantastic. But he was still able to convince his white constituents to keep getting him back into office despite those positions. Nobody else, I mean, other candidates couldn't do that.
Other candidates tended to get elected and disappear. Charlie, through those 12 years, from the time he left, he took a 30-day leave of absence, which was probably illegal. And ran for state rep and won against an incumbent. He's a believable guy. And then he would follow through, and he built relationships. I started to tell you about relationships up here. When we came to Washington, he developed a relationship with the most unlikely people that you could think of. Bill Abzug, California brothers, Phil, and that were destined for leadership at some point. Goodness, one's from San Francisco, one's somewhere else. long time ago.
It's not the Coelho's, is it?
Who?
Coelho's? Is
no,
that
not the no. Coelho.
Coelho. It's not the end.
No, no. I'll think of it. Anyway, he developed a relationship with him. They were a group of progressives.
Okay.
That other people would call liberals.
Okay.
And he also got acquainted with people in the New York delegation. Mm-hmm. He made a point of getting acquainted with people. He did not like to sit around with people who weren't doing anything except saying no, today we would say. And he was not part of that. He wanted to be out there. And the Texas delegation, it was the best delegation in the country for years and years and years. Sam Rayburn had set up when he was here a luncheon at noon Wednesday, right across from the cafeteria. Y'all probably know all about this, but then stop me. But anyway, that was open every Wednesday, and the delegation could bring a guest with them to three of those. But the fourth one was closed. And that was when they discussed what we're going to do as a delegation. And Charlie participated in that. But when you come to Washington and there are five committee chairmen sitting there around that table already, how are you going to get to do anything as a freshman or a sophomore? When are they going to die? Or get beat? And there were five of them. And so he developed relationships with other people out here as well. And also, if you look at East Texas, go through it and break down the industries that it had that were huge main industries. There wasn't a defense plant. There were some old rickety shipbuilding plants down at Orange and Vidor and Port Arthur, which is not in the district, and Beaumont. But there was nothing. And there were a lot of chicken plants, poultry plants. And that paper mill, some very strong ones and very good ones, but there was not national groups. So he could do what he wanted to as long as he took care of Lufkin Industries. That's the only oil industry they really had. They built the best pumping units in the world and still do. They were strong, and the paper mills were strong. But he knew that industry. He'd been there. He'd lived amongst it. So anyway, that helped him when he sat down with all of those people. Strong members of Congress. Democrats were in power. They had chairmanships that were extremely important, including appropriations. And Tiger Teague, who had been one of those that scaled the heights in World War II, going into France as a colonel leading his battalion, was the chairman of the delegation. So they had strength. Mm-hmm. He paid attention to them. He watched them operate. He learned. He didn't say anything much until the first election after he was up here. And then there was one West Texas congressman that was keep... Charlie had made friends with all of this various sort individuals. He voted for their issues in New York. He voted for their issues in San Francisco or Chicago or wherever it was. Mm-hmm. He earned some payback, if you want to look at it that way, are swapping from these young Turks that were coming in. He had practiced it in the Senate in Texas. And these old heads just didn't realize that. By that time, there were five out of that Senate that he'd worked with that were now up here as congressmen. And then there were some wise old men up here, too. Jack Brooks was a chairman.
Brooks was here. Mahon was around, and O.C. Fisher's still around.
Yes, and Pogue, and Wright Patman, and Jim Wright. Yeah. I mean, it was a strong delegation. And Charlie paid attention to it. And when White, is that his name? I believe from El Paso, who was not a strong member, but was moving up seniority because everything was based on seniority. And you got your job by seniority. And the Democrats gained some seats. Charlie's colleagues were coming in, and he told them that he wanted to get on appropriations. And I wasn't in the room. Nobody was in the room, and no staffer. But things leak out. He told me to tell you what he wanted you to know. But Barbara Jordan was there. And he and Barbara Jordan were as close as anybody ever was. And Mickey Leland was too, although they didn't always agree. Mickey was a little more aggressive for black issues. But Barbara Jordan was extremely wise. Jack Hightower came in later, and several others. Charlie knew that he would have a few votes if he challenged him on anything. So he said he wanted to Dick White, because who it was from El Paso. He said I'd like to have that seat. Because there was a vacancy. There was a Texas seat there, vacancy. And Mr. Mahon looked at him and says, "Charlie, that's not the way we do things in here. We have seniority. You have to wait a while, as good as you are." And it'll come to you. Charlie says, "Well, I think I've got the votes to do it." "No, you can't do that." Jack Brooks sitting over there says, "Like hell he can't." So I got the word. And we had planes waiting. They would decide. This would then go to the committees. When you organize the new Congress, and the votes would be taken. A lot of the members would be out of town, and so their votes would get cashed by other folks. So we had private planes hired. If we needed to fly down and pick somebody up, it would be a key vote, we'd do it, because they had obligations in their home district, so they could come in and vote. We were ready. And he won it. And he broke that Sam Rayburn tradition that had been in place for 30 years. Simply because he wanted to have a say. Instead of sitting here forever and ever and ever.
Just waiting for somebody to move on. So would you call him a powerful congressman?
I would call him... if you ask any other... Well, if you ask Martin Frost in the Texas delegation, he'd say yes. If you ask Jim Wright, he'd say yes. If you ask others in the delegation, maybe. But he was influential. It was not power. Okay. It was influence. He did things for you that you ultimately owed him. He could do anything for the Navy that he wanted to do, or from military, and not be criticized for it, because he didn't have any plants in his district. Not one had that did major work for defense industry.
What would you?
And he wanted it that way.
What would you call his style? I mean, you know, it's probably not as aggressive as the Johnson treatment, as people used to call it. I mean, was it a subtle form of?
It was friendly. You knew if you were, quote, a buddy with Charlie Wilson. Joe Christie knew.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie had the shrewdest mind for who to put the finger on, that is, of the elected officials, to get something done, of anybody I have ever met. And so they knew that he could work with people that if they worked with those same people openly, they'd be voted out of office.
Mm-hmm. But he got away with it.
He got away with it. The people loved him because he went down there with his 33rd and his hound dog and visited them, sat down on the front porch and talked to them.
Mm-hmm.
How much influence he had with other people, businessmen, I don't know. But I think there was tremendous respect for Arthur Temple in East Texas. And if Arthur Temple would, quote, put up with him, there must be something good about him. And they all would do that. Nacogdoches wasn't all that excited about Arthur Temple. Arthur supported the university, or the college as it was back then, and did other things for him and helped make East Texas run, but he was concerned about Lufkin and Dybul more than he was up there, but they did respect him. And I told Archie, I hadn't told you all, but I don't think I might have told you, Paul, I can't remember. The night that Dr. Chamberlain ran for county Democratic chairman, Gillette Tilford, who, by the way, his picture I discovered was in one of my book in there somewhere that I hadn't remembered. But the night of the election for county chairman, he went down to J.C. Stallings' radio station, which was the only one in town, and about 10 o'clock that night to give his concession speech. And he said, I don't want to concede anything, but I just want all of my friends in East Texas to know that we were defeated tonight by that dastardly coalition of the SFA History Department and the Nigger Voter League.
Mm. Wow. What year was this?
This was 66.
Wow.
That went out all over the airways. I've never forgotten it because coming from West Texas, it wasn't the same.
Well, I just try to tell these people that didn't happen in West Texas.
No,
those things didn't happen like that, and it's a shock.
Yeah.
When you get, and this is kind of off subject, while we have you. Did you know Arthur Weaver?
I met Arthur Weaver for the first time when we integrated. My wife was a den mother for our son in the Cub Scouts, and it was a segregated Boy Scouts operation there, and we felt like it was time that we get it that it should be integrated, and so we asked Arthur Weaver and Max Stripling, Lanky Williams, see my curves. One or two, there were five of the local businessmen to come visit with us about it and see if there's one time that we could do something about that. And so they did. They met in our living room. Mm-hmm. And they agreed to get together then and discuss it, and they decided that it would be fine. Because I knew that if the college professors all tried to do it, it probably wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. It needed to be done with everybody in the community.
Yeah.
And that happened. It was integrated and began to grow then from that.
Mm-hmm. Did Charlie and Arthur know each other?
Did who?
Charlie and Arthur Weaver, did they know each other?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Charlie knew all about the community.
Okay.
Black ministers were a power and in East Texas, and so, yeah, Charlie and he knew each other as well. Charlie was not invited to come to Nacogdoches. No money raised for him except a little dab that I... Arthur called about 30 of them up and said, I want this much money for you guys, from you guys. He got part of it. And he said, I want to come talk to you. And but it was just, I mean, they weren't going to support Charlie at all.
Why?
Because Charlie's too liberal. And he was from Angelina County, not from Nacogdoches County.
As you said, that river might as well be a wall.
Yeah. Which one was more important?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And so anyway, if you talk to Kyle, I'm taking too long.
No.
Oh, no.
We'll
just bring him in.
A story about him. We'd come out of Austin. And they'd been integrated there. Uh-huh. And there wasn't any problem. We lived right off the university on West 22nd Street, and I was in graduate school. And he went to an integrated first grade or first two grades there. And but he naturally, like all boys, wanted to play Little League ball. Mm-hmm. And we got there just in time for him to enroll. We went out to where they were enrolling them, and all of the white boys were out on the diamond, and they were hitting and being tested for picking up grounders, catching flies, and all this. All the black boys were scattered around the field on their own, wishing they could play.
And this is almost 20 years after Jackie Robinson.
Yeah. And one of those, they did hit a grounder to one of the white boys, and he'd miss it. Mm-hmm. Little black boy would be down there and scoop that sucker up, fire it back to out of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they'd run down a fly, they'd do this and that. Mm-hmm. Coaches standing around, white coaches. Some, you know, were beginning, it was getting to them a little. So it didn't take but 2 or 3 years. Yeah. Well, actually, it was the next year, I think.
The desire to win overcomes some of that sometimes.
Yeah, it did. And so they were integrated and they played. Mm-hmm. The schools were not integrated until Kyle was a seventh grader. And they were required to come up with a plan, and they did. And they started integrating them at seventh grade. Then next year it'd be seventh and eighth. Next year it would be 7th, 8th, and 9th, and until that would give E.J. Campbell students that were freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors a chance to finish their school and graduate from E.J. Campbell, which was a black school.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I think, wanted to do a lot of that too. So it was Kyle's class then was first graduating class that was integrated. And he didn't graduate me. But he was thrown with them because he participated in all four sports. He was the only white boy that lettered in four sports his sophomore year. And he did very well. I think it was bloodlines, but they never passed
my his mother's a great athlete. you're in a unique position to kind of give us some perspective too. We talk about politics and philosophy because you work for Charlie, and then you went to work for Lloyd Benson.
Yeah.
How would you compare them in ideas and philosophy and style?
The easiest way to compare them is that Charlie Wilson is the brightest person I ever worked with.
Okay.
In that he could see an issue, make a decision, cut away all the BS, go to the heart of it, and then come up with five ways to make it happen. Lloyd Benson was the wisest person that I ever worked with. He could also take those issues and break them down, but he took a much more orderly way to get there. And he wanted to know everything there was about the way you make a nail before he would support it. He wanted to know what metal it was made out of. I mean, just everything about it. Mm-hmm. And they both had hearts that you couldn't hold in your hand. Mm-hmm. Benson had made his fortune. Charlie, I don't know what he was even looking for here at that point, but he needed money. But Charlie was fun. Benson was okay too, but that way. But I know that a number of his staff, he did not mingle with his staff. Uh-huh. As much as he didn't mingle with his staff much, but that's the difference of the House and the Senate. Yeah. And so you're trying to compare
politically. Were they pretty close to each other?
Absolutely. If Charlie Wilson called Benson and needed something, Benson wouldn't say, "I'll do it." He might ask him what Arthur thought. He might ask him who other people thought that he knew in East Texas, because he represented East Texas too.
Yeah.
And he had his people, and he wanted to be sure it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Toughest vote I ever saw Benson make was one also dealing with minorities, and it had to do with whether you're going to do away with the program that allowed the Mexicans to come across the border and work in American lands and then go back home at night. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that, as you know, along the border. Mm-hmm. And some wanted to do away with it and not let them come across at all. And I sat over in his hideaway, not in the Capitol. Every senator has a
little place they can go.
And some of them are not so little. And so they're there for votes and debates, and they can do business, and you can go and bring your secretary or somebody or their LAs over and work there as well as over here. And he wanted me to go with him that day, and I went over and sat there, and we talked about it, that he should protect the rights of some people to be able to come across and legitimately work at jobs that were excess, in effect. And he voted to continue to allow it. Now, Benson's family owned the largest farm, a ranch, properties in Texas, except for the King Ranch. They developed the Ruby Red grapefruit. Yep. They did, Mr. Benson was a, he's something.
Yeah, he was. I mean, that's just, yeah. Something like this for him would be great, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was no, I mean, Benson beat Yarbrough, who's the liberal's darling, in 70, but that Charlie didn't, I mean, where did Charlie fall on that?
On that race?
Yeah.
He was gung-ho. Well, Benson, he was gung-ho for Yarbrough. I was Yarbrough's Nacogdoches County.
Is that right?
Campaign manager.
What was that?
So you've got differences of opinion with people that way, but Charlie and Lloyd Benson, they would not vote against each other. They wanted Charlie more than Benson. I mean, Charlie wanted to know what Benson was going to do before he'd vote on most issues, because he had to have his vote too to make things happen a lot of times.
This is not perfect. Where was Benson's office in here in this building?
I don't know where he's been. It wasn't in this building when I
was. He was in the other building.
Yeah, I was in the Hart building.
Okay, so
the new building.
Okay.
He was here in this building when he first came up here, I think. But he was at 7.
Your office is in the other building.
Yeah.
Then, so.
Yeah.
Reading through Creel's book, and give you a chance to respond to some of it. One of his contentions in the book was that why you left Charlie, and it was something to the effect that you were tired of the good time Charlie stuff. But I was wondering if you could answer, if you want, about why you had left working for Charlie.
Two reasons. One major reason is I came with him. I set up the office. I interviewed 200 people before we hired anybody.
Wow.
And had an agreement with, I did. The salaries were not that great. Mm-hmm. They were a little bit better than you've been pleading in your emails that professors make in the But I understand exactly what you're saying. And I had two kids. Mm-hmm. Kyle decided that he would not go to the University of Virginia. Instead, he'd go Ivy League on me. He was offered a scholarship at Texas. But he decided he wanted to go to Brown. And you can ask him about that. But it's a straightforward thing. He did well here. He made all district football in the metropolitan area. And was a very, very good punter and safety. And there's an end. No, I didn't bring it down. He didn't talk about it much. But anyway, he did well here. Mm-hmm. And it kept him from wanting to go back to Nacogdoches. Mm-hmm. Radio station, by the way, blasted his father the last game he played in for taking him away.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Oh, man, well, don't mess with football.
So those the two reasons were to...
One was that I needed to make some more money.
Yeah.
In order for both kids to go to school.
Yeah.
They were 3 years apart, but and that was big bucks.
Yeah.
I'd take out a second mortgage on my house.
Yeah.
And yet I made good money. I'm not complaining about that. I made the max that could be made by Stafford.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't get a scholarship at Brown because I made $29,000 that year.
Yeah.
And $25,000, if you made more than $25,000, they wouldn't give him a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
So we had to do something. Anyway, our daughter went to the University of Virginia, and that was a lot easier. Until she went to graduate school in Boston, too. But anyway, I had been there a long time, mm-hmm. and I had to get out and find some work that would pay more money.
Okay.
Charlie's shenanigans were a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't that serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always one. Oh, that had to help him get them resolved. Now, he already had them figured out how he resolved them.
You had to make it happen.
He made a lot of it. I won't take any credit from him because he could do that too.
Mm-hmm.
But the last thing that happened was like that. It was the August recess, and he ran into the car on the bridge over
on
here.
On the Key Street
bridge. Yeah, Key Bridge, yeah. And he called me, and I found my notes. I didn't know I still had them. That I took talking on the telephone to him at 6:45 that morning. When he called and said, "Simpson, the Navy is here to pick me up, and I'm going to be gone for a month." I knew he was leaving. I thought that wasn't a surprise. And he said, "There's a young man that had a wreck on the bridge and thinks that I hit him. Take care of it." Hmm. And he says, "Call this guy, this guy, this guy." Well, one of them was the staff director of this is another shrewd thing Charlie did.
Mm-hmm.
Staff director of the District of Columbia Appropriations Subcommittee.
Mm.
The Texas delegation had asked Charlie if he would serve as chairman of that subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
For a year, because it was considered a no value committee,
mm-hmm.
the subcommittee on District of Columbia, nobody wanted it. Mm-hmm. But there were three member Texans that were senior,
mm-hmm.
and they were ones that were expected to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they persuaded him to take it, and like a fox, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And this helped. Because he was the guy that appropriated the money for the District of Columbia. This happened in the District of Columbia, but it was the Arlington police that came and got his car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Illegally, out of his garage. He did leave the scene, but he says, "I hit the bridge railing. I'm sure that's what it was. But if there's damage on the boy's car, will you get it fixed while I'm gone?" Well, he had a new Mazda, whatever the number was of Mazda sports car. He had just come to town. So Charlie, I picked up the phone and I called Charlie's lawyer, because this was happening at the same time the drug investigation was going on. And I said to the lawyer, are you still on Charlie's payroll? And he said, yeah. I said, well, Charlie's got a job for you. His car was confiscated by the Arlington police last night. He wants you to go get it out of the pound, wherever they have put it. I don't know where it is. Mm-hmm. And put it back in his garage. Well, it was a Continental mark, whatever the latest mark was at that time, in the hood.
Hey there.
Was bent up in the middle of it.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Take a break out of the bathroom, and Kyle will come.
Yeah, well,
take a little break, and Kyle, and you continue, and maybe we'll just do this together. Is that okay?
Fine with me.
Oh, okay.
Scott's
great.
Nice to meet you.